Welcome to the Earth First Update, bringing you all the environmental news you can use for over 20 years. I'm Uncle Dennis, here in the studio of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, the 20th of April, 2017. Please have a pencil and paper handy so you can write down names, addresses, telephone numbers, web pages, emails, so you can take action for the environment. Let's start with announcements. The Alameda Creek Alliance is having an Earth Day cleanup in Niles, California on Sunday, April 23rd. We'll be picking up trash and continue clearing invasive plants at our adopted restoration site in Lower Niles Canyon. We have a particularly large area of trash along Alameda Creek that we're hoping to clear this Earth Day. We also have people pulling invasive Cape ivy from trees and doing some light weeding around the ancient native plantings. This continues past work by ACA volunteers, and our efforts will enhance the habitat for fish and wildlife along Alameda Creek for years to come. They meet at 10 a.m. on Sunday at the Niles Staging Area parking lot along Old Canyon Road near Canyon Oaks Court in the Niles area of Fremont. The approximate address is 720 Old Canyon Road, and they'll work there till about noon. If you arrive late, walk upstream along Alameda Creek Trail through the picnic area and past the small stone building. We'll be working on a small swale between the creek and Old Canyon Road just before the path narrows into a foot trail. Please wear long pants and sturdy closed-toed shoes that can get dirty. Please no sandals or flip-flops. We do provide gloves and tools. The work isn't on much of a slope, but the ground can be uneven. The ground may be wet, so please wear clothes that can get dirty. There is no poison oak in the immediate area. Expect cool weather and morning dew when we start. Heavy rain cancels. There's none in the forecast, and all participants need a signed waiver form, one for the Alameda Creek Alliance and another for Alameda County, and anyone under 18 years old needs a parental signature. Once again, that's this Sunday, April 23rd, in Niles Canyon, for the Alameda Creek Alliance cleanup. And consumers are urged not to eat sport-harvested bivalve shellfish in Santa Barbara County. The California Department of Public Health has warned consumers not to eat recreationally harvested bivalve shellfish such as mussels, clams, or whole scallops from Santa Barbara County, including the North Channel area. North Channel Islands, dangerous levels of domoic acid have been detected in mussels from this region, making them and other shellfish unsafe to consume. Domoic acid is a naturally occurring toxin that comes from algae in the water. Dangerous levels of the toxin can cause amnesic shellfish poisoning in humans, which can cause illness or death. Although no cases of human poisoning from domoic acid are known to have occurred in California, symptoms of domoic acid poisoning can occur within 30 minutes to 24 hours after eating toxic seafood. Mild cases, the symptoms include vomiting, diarrhea, abdominal cramps, headache, and dizziness. These symptoms disappear within several days. In severe cases, the victim will have trouble breathing, confusion, disorientation, cardiovascular instability, seizures, excessive bronchial secretions, permanent loss of short-term memory, coma, or death. This warning does not apply to commercially sold clams, mussels, scallops, or oysters from approved sources. State law permits only state-certified commercial shellfish harvesters or dealers to sell these products. Shellfish sold by certified harvesters and dealers are subject to frequent mandatory testing to monitor for toxins. And once again, if you're in the Santa Barbara County area or the North Channel Islands, please do not eat bivalve shellfish, such as clams, mussels, or scallops. Turning to the Buffalo Field Campaign's update for the week, the first calf arrives and buffalo are dancing with no snow to hold them back. A buffalo nation is coming. Almost all of the snow is gone now, save for a few shady north-facing slopes and mountain peaks. Hebgen Lake is opening up, turning back into water. Buffalo families continue to migrate through the Hebgen Basin, and they dance with no snow to hold them back. Adult females are showing off enormous bellies, and the first calf was just spotted by our lucky patrols early this morning. Here they come, the next generation of wild buffalo, and most of them will grow strong peacefully in their new year-round habitat. We have seen Montana Department of Livestock agents driving around the basin with more frequency as they search for buffalo to bully. So far, they have been coming away mostly empty-handed. The groups of buffalo we were concerned about along the south side of the Madison River, where they are not allowed to be, have gone elsewhere. There was, however, an unfortunate incident over the weekend. Buffalo had walked onto private land of hobby rancher Pat Pova, and one bull was promptly shot and killed. Aside from this unnecessary killing, all is now quiet on the western front. Have you saved the date? In addition to running daily and nightly patrols, we are also busy gearing up for our 20th anniversary party that will take place in West Yellowstone on May 26th and 27th. Everyone is invited, and we will have more information about that event in upcoming Earth First updates. And the Buffalo Field Campaign is seeking volunteers for their summer outreach program. Volunteers get to spend 5 days a week camping in beautiful Yellowstone National Park. You'll spend your days enjoying all of that landscape has to offer, from relaxing in the boiling river to watching a mama bear, black bear, with her cubs. You'll have an amazing opportunity of seeing wild buffalo during the rut while helping us to do outreach on their behalf. Educating park visitors on the plight of America's last wild bison is one of the most important paths of what we do here at Buffalo Field Campaign. While tabling, you'll meet and bring the buffalo's story to people from all over the world. During their 5 days in the park, volunteers will share a tent at various campgrounds in and around Yellowstone. While not tabling, adventuring in the park is one of the many benefits of summers in Yellowstone, with plenty of places to hike, swim, or enjoy nature. Just don't try driving anywhere. Volunteers will have 2 days a week at Buffalo Field Campaign headquarters near West Yellowstone. Please send an email to volunteersummer@buffalofieldcampaign.org. That's volunteersummer@buffalofieldcampaign.org, or call us at 406-646-0070. That number again, 406-646-0070. And do visit their website at www.buffalofieldcampaign for all this information, news, and more. And the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project is asking folks to support them. The Forest Service is putting out a lot of timber sales this spring, and please send comments to the Forest Service on the Ragged Ruby Project timber sale. Those comments are due by April 24th. Even brief comments are helpful and make a difference. The Ragged Ruby area has been heavily logged already, but still has stunning large creeks supporting bull trout, steelhead trout, and red band trout habitat for Columbia spotted frogs, potential long-toed salamander habitat, and a high number of documented martens, a vulnerable rank species in the weasel family. The Ragged Ruby area contains some of the last unlogged old-growth moist mixed conifer forest in the project area. The forest badly needs a break from logging, yet the Forest Service is planning to log 5,930 acres commercially, plus some commercial logging in the riparian habitat conservation areas. Those are the beautiful areas along the creeks, and unquantified heavy equipment use in tree felling and tipping for large wood placement in up to 35 to 56 miles of creeks. Forest Service also includes some planned improvements in trail systems for hikers, mountain bikers, horse riders in and around Dixie Butte, Greenhorn Mountain inventoried roadless areas, but also some unspecified tree felling around western white pine and white bark pine, prescribed burning in the roadless areas, and some scabland lithosol habitat enhancement through felling juniper and ponderosa pine in the Dixie Butte roadless area. Forest Service is also planning highly destructive forest plan amendments to allow violation of existing forest plan standards in order to allow logging of large trees over 21 inches in diameter, logging in old-growth forest, and reduction of forest cover for elk and deer to below forest plan standards. Blue Mountain Biodiversity Project opposes these unnecessary forest plan amendments and the heavy, extensive logging and overmanagement planned in the Ragged Ruby area. You send your comments to comments-pacific-northwest-malheur-blue-mountain@fs.fed.us. Once again, that's comments-pacific-northwest-malheur, spelled M-A-L-H-U-E-R, /blue-mountain@fs.fed.us. And please visit their webpage at bluemountainsbiodiversity.org for more information about this or other conservation projects. And a natural gas leak in the Cook Inlet has been stopped, but the effects on marine life are not yet known. Nearly 4 months after an underwater pipeline began leaking almost pure methane into Alaska's Cook Inlet, Hilcorp Alaska announced on Friday that a temporary repair has stopped the leak. The clamp assures a gas-tight, liquid-tight seal that will reinforce the pipeline, Hilcorp said in a press release. The next step will be send divers back down to make a permanent repair. The company had gradually decreased the amount of gas flowing through the leaking pipeline, but for much of those 4 months, it was releasing more than 200,000 cubic feet of natural gas into the Cook Inlet every day. Not much is known about the impacts of a methane leak on marine environments, but the leak alarmed regulators, scientists, and environmentalists because the Cook Inlet is home to the endangered beluga whale. There was no environmental monitoring until mid-March when Hilcorp reported finding low oxygen and high methane levels at some sites near the leak. Those results were deemed incomplete, however, and the state wrote to Hilcorp that its samples did not appear to have been taken at the maximum most probable concentrations from the bubble field. The divers have been able to determine that the leak was caused by a boulder, said Kristen Ryan, a director of spill prevention and response at the Alaskan Department of Environmental Conservation. A 3-foot by 3-foot boulder appears to have rolled over the pipeline, causing it to bend. At the bottom of the bend, there was a small crack, roughly 3/16 of an inch long by 3/8 of an inch wide. Ryan said it wasn't surprising the boulder cracked the line. Historically, that what has happened on that line before, she said. Cook Inlet is known for violent currents and some of the strongest tides in the world, meaning that water moves rapidly and with great force. As the seabed shifts below a pipeline, a line can be left hanging, leaving it vulnerable to battering. There were two such leaks on this pipeline in 2014 before Hilcorp owned it. Now that the leak has been stopped, Bob Shavelson of the nonprofit Cook Inlet Keeper said he's concerned about the company's other operations in the state. If it takes Hilcorp months and months to shut down a leaky gas line, we need to reevaluate whether they can operate in winter, he said. Hilcorp's business model is to buy older oil and gas infrastructure from other companies. It's a model that has paid off. The company, founded in 1989, is one of the largest privately owned oil and gas companies in the world. Hilcorp owns much of the oil and gas infrastructure in the inlet. Most of it, including the cracked natural gas line, is more than 50 years old. Its recent problems in Cook Inlet have raised questions about whether these old pipelines can continue to function safely. Since identifying the pipeline leak on February 7th, the following things have happened. The Federal Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration ordered Hilcorp to repair the pipeline by May 1st and required a comprehensive safety inspection of the line. PHMSA later issued an order requiring additional inspections of a nearby oil pipeline. Agency said conditions on that line existed that could pose a pipeline integrity risk to public safety, property, or the environment. After talks with Governor Bill Walker, Hilcorp shut down oil production on the two platforms that were powered by the gas in the pipeline and lowered pressure in the line by more than half. On April 1st, Hilcorp employees on another oil platform, the Anna, reported feeling an impact and then observed a small oil sheen. The company said that less than 3 gallons of oil leaked. Subsequent inspections of the line determined it was not a pipeline leak, but involved the temporary use of oil in a flaring process. Less than a week later, on April 7th, the company reported a third problem on a different natural gas pipeline after discovering a leak there. Hilcorp immediately shut down that line, and PHMSA is investigating. Now that the leak has stopped, the agencies can shift from spill response to investigating what happened and why. Ryan said she expects her agency to review all existing oil and gas infrastructure within the Cook Inlet. And we want to thank Sabrina Shankman for that article found in Inside Climate News. And Trump has been sued for revoking protection for Alaskan wolves and bears. The Center for Biological Diversity took the Trump administration to court again this week, this time for a first-of-its-kind constitutional challenge aimed at Trump's decision to end an Obama rule protecting wolves and bears at Alaska's wildlife refuges from being killed in their dens or gunned down from the air. President Trump signed legislation April 3rd that was rushed through Congress under the Congressional Review Act. Our suit challenges the constitutionality of that act, a 1996 law allowing legislators to appeal federal regulations adopted in the last few months of the previous presidential administration. Before 2017, Congress had successfully used the act only once in 2001, but Trump and the current Congress have now used it to revoke 13 different Obama-era regulations. The fight is on to stop Trump's disgusting wildlife-killing laws. And Dow Chemical halts work protecting species from pesticides. Dow Chemical is pushing the Trump administration to abandon legally mandated efforts to protect endangered species from three dangerous pesticides. The ploy to abandon nearly a four-year effort to safeguard endangered species from these pesticides was revealed in letters obtained by the Center for Biological Diversity. Dow wants the Trump administration and EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt to withdraw biological evaluations that were finalized in January, detailing how the highly toxic organophosphate insecticides, chlorpyrifos, malathion, and diazinon, harm nearly 1,800 threatened and endangered species of plants and animals. Unable to win on the facts, Dow is now adopting the same disgraceful tactics honored by the tobacco industry and the climate deniers to try and discredit science and scrap reasonable conservation measures that will protect our most endangered animals and plants, said the Center for Biological Diversity's Brett Hardy. And Wildlife Services has been sued over a Colorado carnivore killing. In December of 2016, the state of Colorado approved a highly controversial plan to use Wildlife Services, the federal government's animal extermination arm, to kill as many as 120 mountain lions and black bears in a misguided experiment for the benefit of hunters. So along with our allies, the Center for Biological Diversity sued the Wildlife Services over its Colorado scheme. I'm outraged that Colorado plans to kill bears and mountain lions to boost deer populations for hunters, said the Center for Biological Diversity's Colette Adkins. The state relies on outdated and unscientific thinking that disregards the importance of predators. The scientific study our lawsuit seeks would show that Colorado's predator killing program is ecologically harmful, as well as ineffective and cruel. And the Center for Biological Diversity is seeking records on the ties from Monsanto to the EPA. The Center for Biological Diversity and the U.S. Right to Know have submitted requests under the Freedom of Information Act seeking public records to determine whether pesticide giant Monsanto inappropriately influenced the Environmental Protection Agency in its declaration that the toxic chemical glyphosate, the main ingredient of Roundup, does not cause cancer. With many independent studies linking glyphosate to cancer, said Center for Biological Diversity senior scientist Nathan Donnelly, it's vital to understand how much influence Monsanto has on the agency that's supposed to protect our public health. And Endangered Species Act protection has been sought for giraffes. Africa's giraffe population has plunged nearly 40% over the past three decades, largely due to mounting habitat loss, hunting for meat, and international trade in bone carvings and trophies. That's why the Center for Biological Diversity and their allies have filed a suit to protect giraffes under the U.S. Endangered Species Act. The United States imported more than 21,400 bone carvings, 3,000 skin pieces, and 3,700 hunting trophies over the past decade, so limiting the import will give giraffes important protections. There are now fewer giraffes than elephants in Africa, said the Center for Biological Diversity's Tanya Sanarib. It's time for the United States to step up and protect these extraordinary creatures. and a Bureau of Land Management fracking plan endangered sage grouse in Utah. The Bureau of Land Management is proposing to auction off 15,000 acres of public land in Utah for fracking and drilling, a move that will hurt local greater sage grouse that are already in trouble. The Sheeprock's population of sage grouse in central Utah has dropped by nearly 40% over the past 4 years. Despite admitting that the Sheeprock's population is in critical condition and requires more protection, BLM officials want to encourage drilling in the sagebrush, said the Center for Biological Diversity's Michael Saul. It makes no sense. Land titling for indigenous communities leads to forest protection, a peer-reviewed study has found. The story was reported by Michael Gaworicki of Manga Bay and found on the Intercontinental Cry. New research provides yet more evidence that granting indigenous and other local communities formal title to their traditional lands can be a boon to efforts to conserve forests. Deforestation is responsible for as much as 10% of global carbon emissions, which means that finding effective means of keeping forests standing is crucial to global efforts to halt climate change. Previous studies have found that securing indigenous land rights is a successful path to keeping forests and the carbon sinks they represent intact. A 2016 analysis by the World Resources Institute focused on Bolivia, Brazil, and Colombia, for instance, determined that tenure-secure indigenous forest lands could help avoid the release of carbon emissions equivalent to taking 9 to 12 million passenger vehicles off the road over the next 20 years. According to another report released last year as part of a collaborative research project by the Woods Hole Research Center, the Rights and Resources Initiative, and WRI, there is a lot of carbon stored on indigenous lands, making increased land titling a significant opportunity for climate mitigation. But the research found that while indigenous peoples and other local forest communities manage at least 24% of the carbon stored above ground in Earth's tropical forests, or some 54,546 million metric tons of carbon, more than 22,000 million metric tons of carbon of that is at risk of deforestation or degradation because it is found in regions where the local communities do not enjoy formal recognition of their claim to the land. A more recent study not only found that well-trained indigenous technicians are every bit as capable of collecting the necessary data to monitor forest carbon stocks as professionals, but that in some cases, at least, they can do it quicker and cheaper than the pros. The efficacy of land titling as a forest protection measure are less clear, however, but the authors of a study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences recently say that they found that forest clearance is actually reduced by more than 3/4 and forest disturbance by roughly 2/3 over a 2-year time span immediately following the granting of land title to an indigenous community. A team of researchers in Washington, D.C.-based research institution Resources for the Future, the Inter-American Development Bank, and the Carnegie Institution for Science used high-resolution satellite images to examine 11 million hectares, that's over 27 million acres of forest, that have been titled to more than 1,200 indigenous communities in Peru since the mid-1970s. They say their findings, which focused on the effect titling had on forest clearing and disturbance in the Peruvian Amazon between 2002 and 2005, suggests that the increasing trend towards decentralized forest government via granting indigenous groups and other local communities formal legal title to their lands could play a key role in global efforts to slow both tropical forest destruction, which the researchers note is responsible for about the same amount of greenhouse gas emissions as the transportation sector, and climate change. Granting indigenous and other local communities formal title to forests that have traditionally sustained them is probably the most important trend in tropical forest policy over the last 30 years. Dr. Alan Blackman, researcher at Resources for the Future and the study's lead author, said in a statement, "These local communities now manage almost 1/3 of all forests in developing countries, over twice the share currently found in government-run protected areas, yet we know very little about titling's effects on forest cover." And an offshore wind development is threatening the roseate tern in this story from the American Bird Conservancy. anticipating increased mortality to the endangered roseate tern from planned offshore wind development on the Atlantic coast. Conservation groups are asking federal agencies to take steps to protect the remaining population of these already threatened birds. The American Bird Conservancy and several other national regional conservation organizations have submitted a letter to federal authorities expressing their concerns. The birds' range and behavior make them especially vulnerable to harm from offshore energy facilities. The federally endangered roseate tern migrates and forages far off the coast during breeding season, putting it at risk from collisions with the rapidly spinning turbine blades, said Dr. Michael Hutchins, director of ABC's BirdSmart Wind Energy Program. We need to see how projected offshore wind energy development will affect this species and how unavoidable impacts can be minimized. The roseate tern migrates the length of the eastern seaboard, which means it could be impacted by large-scale industrial offshore wind development that has been proposed by the U.S. Department of Interior's Bureau of Ocean Energy Management off the coasts of South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, Maryland, Delaware, New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Maine. Environmental impact statements and consultation with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will likely be required for every project, Hutchins said. The large Cape Wind project was halted off the coast of Massachusetts in part because of concerns over this and other federally protected species. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org. You can hear a rebroadcast of this show tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. You could also listen to WMNB 107.1 in North Adams, Massachusetts, Friday at 5:30 p.m. KRFP 90.3 Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. KOWA 106.5 in Olympia, Washington, Saturdays at 7 a.m. WLSL 92.7 Dade City, Florida, Sundays at noon. KHCF 89.9 in Morgan Hill, Gilroy, KGIG 104.9 Modesto, KPHD 93.3 in Modesto, and Berkeley Liberation Radio at 104.1 in Berkeley, California, all broadcast the Earth First Update. Please check with them for their times. You can find us on the internet at Grateful Dread Public Radio, gdprnashville.org, Sundays at 2 a.m., or you can always go to radioforall.net, where you can listen online or download this or previous Earth First Updates. That's radioforall.net. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and broadcast. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio, produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis, and I want to thank you for listening, and please do tune in to the Earth First Update. We will be taking a vacation for the next 2 weeks.